This is Pet Life Radio. Let's talk pets.
And we are live here on Pet Life Radio and Ask the Vet with Dr. Jeff, as well as our Instagram Live. And my sister Bethany is the first one to wave at me. Good morning, good morning. And hopefully a lot of you will join me. And hello, I'm going to say hi as the wave's coming in. So, as you know the drill, we're here for you, here for your pets. Anything you want to talk about, now is the time to do it, because guess what? It's free advice. Who doesn't like free? So, take advantage of it. You can tell me, ask me anything. Preferably dogs and cats. But I always say, if you have a question about something other than a dog or cat, don't fret, because I will talk to my various friends, colleagues that do exotics or do birds or do anything, and we will get answers for you as well. So Throopy, New York City. Hello, hello. So anyway, I hope everybody had a good week. I hope those of you here in LA are braving this heat. It is hot. And in fact, this morning, Mark, you're like, it was sort of like muggy still, like, you know, Mark, our producer's in Florida, so he knows what muggy is. And we know, our heat's pretty dry, but I got to tell you, it was kind of a little muggy this morning, but yesterday it was really, really hot here. It had to be over 100. And as luck would have it, on Friday afternoon, and this is so typical of my luck, Friday afternoon, 4:30, power goes out. You know, at first I thought it was a grid problem. And you call LAWDWP, impossible. You can never get a live person. So anyway, I'm leaving messages. Oh, can we call? All on recording. Can we call you back? Yeah. And it was supposed to be fixed by something like 8:40 something p.m. Okay. One of my neighbors knocks on our door, and they called at 9:40 something and still not fixed. So then a truck finally shows up on Saturday afternoon. So it's right down the block. Turns out there were about 12 or 13 houses. And of course, mine was the very last house to have the problem. My next door neighbor on the other side was fine. And everybody down the block from there was fine. It was the first five houses of our block and the equivalent houses behind us. So it just didn't make sense that it was a grid, because grids are more than 12, 13 houses. I mean, grids are just tons. So anyway, it turns out it was a transformer. And they fixed it Saturday afternoon. Power went back on for like literally 10, not even 10 minutes. And it went off again. So the same neighbor ran out and said, wait a second, don't go yet. It turned on, now it turned off. Meanwhile, it took them hours. They had to replace all of the cables. I mean, you name it, replace. They were there. Finally, at 9 o'clock p.m. last night, the power went back on. And they were there for hours. It was unbelievable. So, tech with the food. First up, when it happened in the afternoon, Friday afternoon, I was got a lot of our frozen stuff, like meats, things that you know are going to go bad. The ice cream, who could care less? I got to buy more ice cream. But anyway, I mean, literally black, nothing. Even, you know, because we have the tankless water heaters, that runs on electricity too. Everything was dead black. It was so insane. So let me see. Okay. OC flower walls. Just recently, my chubby cat started biting his paws when I pet his back. Got him a steroid shot and hasn't helped. Any ideas? Well, first of all, that would have been my first thought. A lot of times, and I have plenty of cats, and usually when you start petting them, it's exactly what happens, is that they'll bite for anything. Sometimes they'll nibble on me. So if you just got the steroid shot, I would give it a little bit more time. It usually is a scratch reflex, where what happens is when you get that spot, you hit that spot, and then they start like going, in essence, it's almost like they're scratching themselves. One of my cats has a big scab on his back. We don't know how he got it. It wasn't from a fight. I think it was something burned. I think it was maybe sitting too close to the oven or the stove and, you know, hot oil, something. Anyway, when I touch that area, he starts the same thing. So it's a reflex. I would give it a little bit more time. Also check for fleas. Even if you have an indoor-only cat, you can bring a flea in, and the steroid shot alone may not help the fleas, because they feel like they're crawling on them. So I would take, you know, kind of run your hand backwards from the rump forward and look at the skin itself. Now, you may not see live fleas, but you may see like little black specks. That's flea dirt, which is flea. It's basically your cat's dried blood is what it is. I know it's pretty gross, but anyway, that's what you want to do. Okay, I'm so bossy. JB, how are you? So any news on when I was at Super Zoo? So I don't know about any trials that I know of to prolong dogs' lives. I mean, there's a lot out there. And, you know, I think that keeping them obviously lean, keeping them healthy, keeping them, you know, disease-free as best you can, avoiding dangerous situations. For cats, for example, you want to live a long life, don't let them go outside. I mean, if you live in a city, dogs, cars, coyotes, other cats, feline leukemia, feline AIDS. I mean, there's so many things that are contagious out there. I'd be really careful. A lot of his genes. I mean, come on. I just had a terrible case, a 13-month-old cat that has been sort of off, vomiting and diarrhea for a few weeks, taken to a local vet, and they took x-rays. There was something in the X, but nothing. There was no clear proof of an obstruction. So this is when I got involved in the case. I saw the cat, and I mean, it was kind of a nice cat, big cat too, and took x-rays, saw the x-rays. I said, I'll tell you what, let me treat just symptomatically right now, give it some anti-vomiting medication. The bloods, by the way, that they took weren't fine. And we'll give it some fluids and we'll see tomorrow. We'll take another x-ray and see, has anything moved? Second x-ray, nothing really moved. Now, it wasn't a typical obstruction pattern where there was a lot of gas. Everything that we saw was exactly in the same place. And that made me a little concerned. So I said, you know, well, look, it's a Friday. It's been going on for weeks already. We need to be more aggressive. So I go in surgically. It was the weirdest thing. So at first I expected to see something. So I start at the stomach and everything was looked good. I run all the bowel. I mean, running a bowel means you're going through every inch of bowel and you're touching, you're feeling, looking at the color, making sure there's nothing that is there, nothing you could feel. Finally get to the ileocecal junction and I'm at the cecum itself. I can feel a little bit of something, but it not only did it feel just like a little stool ball, but it's sort of where the thing was that we saw over the last 2 days. So I'm thinking, you know what? Something is stuck. I can't figure it out. We get to the colon. Oh my God. The colon was, first of all, 3 or 4 times the size. It was, instead of being a nice bright pink color, showing that there's good blood flow and everything is normal and healthy, it was deep red purple. It was 3 times the thickness, but nothing inside. And I'm thinking, oh my God, this is bad. So I make a little incision and I feel, is there maybe something I couldn't feel? No, I could put my probe all the way down through. So I take a sample and I talk to a colleague of mine who is a boarded internist. What are the possibilities? There was not one good possibility in a 13-month-old cat. When you have this, you got to think of things like, well, first of all, FIP, by the way, all these things are weird. Could happen, but weird. Lymphosarcoma, 13 months old. And I said, David, 13-month-old. He goes, Jeff, I had a 6-month-old dog with lymphosarcoma. So yes, is it normal? No, of course it's not normal, but it can happen. And then you have feline leukemia virus, FELV. Could be a manifestation of an ischemic episode where the blood supply for some reason got caught. All these things, histoplasmosis, all of them are bad prognosis. And you know, given the fact that the cat was very young and there was no fix, no easy fix, and treatment would be time. It's like guarded at best, the prognosis, guarded at best. That means usually poor or grave. If it was ischemic, it was grave. So it means the worst prognosis you can have. Anyway, instead of putting this cat through all of this for who knows how long to try to treat it, and not to mention the finances, and how miserable the cat would be, and that even with success, the cat maybe had best a year and a half, 18 months, it was decided not to cut the loss. I don't mean financial losses. I mean emotional losses. Putting the cat through hell for what? For an extra 6 months? And then what happens during that time? You get even more attached to this cat you've only had for less than a year. And it wasn't a good thing. And in the cat's best interest, we decided to say goodbye. You know how frustrating those cases are? I remember this brought me back to vet school. But my first, when I was on my oncology rotation in vet school at Davis, my first case was a gorgeous, gorgeous 8-month-old golden retriever puppy with fibrosarcoma on his face. There was nothing you can do. I mean, you know, it's like I spoke several weeks ago. I was at Children's Hospital speaking, and I was doing a thing on dog bites. I was handling from the dog end and from the training end and how these future pediatricians can train parents and talk to parents intelligently about dogs. You realize that most dog bites in kids happen from the family dog. I mean, that's a statistic that's pretty well known. So how do we work with them? What can we do? How to avoid them? What to do if you're being chased? All the little things about bites, how to read a dog's posturing. I mean, that's so important to know. And how to approach a dog, a strange dog. And you know, one of the things that I always say that when we have dogs, okay, and we raise our kids with dogs, as I did mine, and now my grandkids all have dogs, they don't know what it's like not. So they have no fear. So all of a sudden they're walking on the streets and they see a dog, and a big dog even. They all have big dogs, right? And they think, oh, they're good. Another dog just like mine. And they want to go up and they want to smooch it. And you got to teach these kids, no, not every dog is like your dog at home. And you got to be careful. And look, I was nailed by my Doberman when I was 5. I had plastic surgery in my face. These things happen. And you got to be really, really careful. Anyway, walking into children, my point was, walking into Children's Hospital, I'm very friendly with one of like the director, one of the head doctors there. And that is that cancer happens in kids too, small kids. And it's so depressing. So when you see an animal where they're just at the beginning of their life and you hear stories like this, I know it's really, really tough. So anyway, it was frustrating for me, but I think honestly, in hindsight, it was a tough decision, but probably the best. Okay, no fleas. So I would say give the shot a little more time. Hey, Steve, give the shot a little more time. New York Yankee, hello. Any recommendations for an elderly dog with arthritis? Oh, God, do we have some? Yes. So first of all, let's go back to weight. Keep them lean. The less stress we have on an older dog with arthritis, the easier it is for them to navigate. Secondly, is any kind of joint supplementation, chondroitin, glucosamine, MSM. They are great products out there. Anti-pain medications. You can use like something, a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory like carprofen, vetprofen, meloxicam. Again, speak to your veterinarian. You got to make sure they're healthy. Galliprant for dogs that are even older and might have questionable liver or kidney issues. Galliprant works really well too. And then one last thing is a new shot. I got to tell you, internet is, as I said, it's a great source of information, also a great source of misinformation. And interestingly, it's the misinformation and the bad stories for whatever reason they happen are the ones that are flooding the internet. And I have my issues with that, but I got to tell you, it's take us back to carprofen years ago, Rimadyl, the original drug. There were two dose ranges. One was a double dose, but it was only meant for 5 days post-op. And a lot of people weren't getting it. It was so new, even the veterinarians didn't get it. And they kept that dose going for longer. And then we had terrible, terrible liver damage, et cetera. It wasn't the drug. It was how it was being used. And Librela, for some reason, though it's been used in Europe for years, I have used it several times. And I mean, several, like dozens upon dozens. And it's relatively new. And I have had clients come in after the month for another shot. Why? Because it was so effective. It worked so well. Now, I went on the internet myself because there were some questions about the data and it's misrepresented and it's really not as good and they manipulated the data. You know, I don't want to get involved in that because I'm not a scientist. It's very statistical analysis and the quotient and P, whatever. I mean, that's great for the statisticians. All I know is as a practical guy, I've tried it and I've heard from colleagues that it was really good. And I've tried it and every single one of my patients on it have done and are doing very well. As I said, to the point where they're actually coming in and asking for the next shot. So you got to talk to your veterinarian, see what he or she says. I would say that in my hands so far, it has been good. And every drug out there has potential for bad reactions. Just listen to any drug commercial on TV and wait it out till the end of the commercial. And you will see, oh my God, and can cause death. I mean, yet they're selling millions upon millions of doses. Because the story of my family was my dad used to take penicillin for any ailment. This is way back in the 50s. And he once had an anaphylactic reaction to penicillin. And it could happen. It just didn't happen immediately. It's like being stung by bees. And the fifth bee sting, you finally get anaphylaxis. So he was advised, obviously, never take it again. Never take an analog. Cephalexins, the cephalosporins are kind of related. Stay away from those. And they said, you know, for your kids as well. So as a kid growing up, whenever I could, I would say on my paperwork when you'd go to a doctor, allergies, it never happened to me, but I put down penicillins. Well, bottom line is I've taken penicillin since. I've taken cephalosporin since. I never had an issue. But it could happen. So just understand, when you're reading this data, read it with that grain of salt and talk to the many, 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 many more people that have had good experiences with it. Am I ready to take it off my shelf or out of the fridge? You store it in the fridge? No. If I started, I'll give you another example. Dextromethorphan, right? It's one of those drugs that we use it all the time. A lot of places use it. There's an antidote. You can reverse it with antecedent. I used it my first time. And the dog, not only was it any dog, it was my friend's dog, had a severe allergic reaction, lungs filling up with fluid. And when you read the data, one in 50,000 cases can have this reaction. Not only did I have it, it was my very first time using it on a friend's dog. How crappy did I feel? But as they say, poop happens. It was a weird thing. I did not use that drug again for a few years. All my clients were, I mean, my associates were using it all the time, loving it. I said, oh, not me. Anyway, I have since. I've overcome it. I've used it tons of times since with no reaction whatsoever. So anyway, Eloise, difference between x-ray and an ultrasound. We'll be right there. So good question. We're going to come back after these short messages. And by the way, more questions. I'm going to go through waving at you, and then I'm going to come back to the question, the difference between x-ray and ultrasound and why often you need both. Don't go away.
Need the perfect gift for the cat lover in your life? Check out ComfortDiva.com. We have cat-tastic gifts to make you smile, like cat-themed tote bags, kitchen towels, quirky mugs, and stylish t-shirts. For holiday gifts or anytime, ComfortDiva.com has it all. Treat the cat lady in your life to something pawsome and save 20% with coupon MEOW20. Visit ComfortDiva.com today because every cat lover deserves a little comfort. ComfortDiva.com, where comfort meets catitude.
Let's talk pets.
Let's talk pets.
On Pet Life Radio.
Pet Life Radio.
PetLifeRadio.com.
And we're back here live. So what I wanted to do, Vicky at Eloise Pet Rescue had a great question about the difference between x-rays and ultrasound. So, okay, first of all, they're both often necessary. It's different information. With an x-ray, you're getting a broad two-view, two-dimension image of an animal. And that's why in any x-ray that you really need to look at something, you need to take two views. You do what's called a VD or a DV, which is dorsoventral or ventrodorsal. You know, on their back, it's a VD. It's where the beam hits first. So if on their back, the beam's going to hit the ventrum first. If they're on their stomachs, the beam is going to hit their dorsum first. And also a lateral. For certain x-rays, certain positioning like heart, we take a left lateral and turn, roll the pet over and do a right lateral. But it's a two-dimensional image. And you're looking at densities. Densities such as when you have the most dense material that you're going to see. And you might see this on an x-ray. It's bright white, whiter than bone. And what anything metallic. When that dog swallows a paperclip or a battery, you're going to see a perfectly shaped, a quarter, a coin, exactly what it looks like. You're going to see it. Then the next bone density we see is bone density. Bone is pretty dense, and that shows up also white, but not quite as bright white. And then you'll see the spine. You can see the long bones. And if they eat a bone, then you'll see that kind of density within the stomach or intestine. Okay. Then the next thing you do is going to be tissue, soft tissue. The thicker, more dense the tissue, the more you'll see. And then, of course, after all the tissues, so for example, if there's a stone in the bladder, the stone is going to be more visible unless some stones are called radiolucent. Those stones you don't see on an x-ray. But if you have therefore, we'll get to ultrasound in a minute. And the last thing we have, fluid. Fluid sometimes overshadows all of it. It gets in the way. And when you see black on an x-ray inside, so if you see a dark area on an x-ray, what are you going to think? You're going to be thinking of like little light fluid. And of course, the most translucent, the most beam that's going to go through easily is air. So of course, lung field. So in a chest x-ray, you'll see the heart and all the black around the heart is air. And then you'll see also, if you look really close, you'll see the bronchi, you'll see some vessels, et cetera. That is what you see on x-ray. Now, how does that differ from an ultrasound? Ultrasound. So based on what I just said, what is your enemy on an x-ray? Your biggest enemy is fluid. So if you have a belly full of fluid, it overshadows pretty much everything. You really can't see anything. Now let's talk an ultrasound where you have the ultrasound wave going through. First of all, you're using a probe and you're seeing the dimensions. Secondly, your biggest friend on an ultrasound is the liquid. Your biggest enemy, okay, is going to be air because it casts a shadow and it sort of leaves like you see these waves around it. So rays of unclear field, that could be because of too much gas. So, but friend, and on an ultrasound, your fluid, liquid is your friend. And then you can see all the different densities. You can see what you could see on an ultrasound you can't see on the x-ray, such as, for example, crystals, urinary crystals. If they're small, you'll pick them up on an ultrasound. That radiolucent stone that you couldn't see on the x-ray, you might, well, probably will see on an ultrasound. And you can't see on an x-ray if there is fluid moving through it, you can't see it. You can see the structure, but you can't see the fluid moving. It's a quick picture in time. It's a frozen 1/30th, 1/60th of a second. That's what you're getting, or faster. Ultrasound, you can see the fluid moving. You can have color flow Doppler on your ultrasound, where you can see the difference between the mixture of the blue, which is venous blood, and red, which is arterial blood. So because you get the oxygenated blood, it shows up differently. You can look at fluid moving. You can look, you know, for example, we have a pregnant dog, okay? It's very hard to count the puppies with ultrasound. All right, you can see each one, but sometimes if they overlap, you don't know which one. Did I count this one already? On an x-ray, it's, again, no one's moving. So you can count, some people count the rib cages, I count the skulls, and you can take a number and get pretty accurate count of how many puppies or kittens, where, as on the ultrasound, you can see the viability. You can actually see, as any mom knows, when she sees her ultrasound, if she was giving birth, you can see the movement. You can see the arms and legs move. You can see the heart pumping. It's amazing. So, you know, usually we oftentimes, it depends what you're looking for. Sometimes you need the ultrasound to evaluate some foreign body or wall thickness. The ultrasound is better. All right. Whereas if you look, taking a picture of a bladder or a heart, you can't see. You can see the overall silhouette of the heart. But that's all an x-ray is. It's a shadow. It casts a beam, and all it's picking on the grid or the old-fashioned film is a shadow. So whereas with the ultrasound, you can actually see wall thickness. You can see movement. You can see flow. It gives you so much more usable information. But that x-ray, you can't do that. When you're looking, for example, at a disc disease or an arthritis, you won't necessarily see that on an ultrasound, but you will see it on an x-ray. So it's never one or the other. Sometimes it's both, and sometimes it is one or the other. And Elijah said a lot of times we learn different information from them. And then next up to that would be either a CT or an MRI. So, and of course, when it comes to expense, typically the x-ray might be the least expensive. Then comes the ultrasound, and then comes the CT, and finally you got the MRI. So if you got that brain lesion, you need an MRI. A disc MRI is probably better, but you know, before MRI, a lot of the radiologists used to do very well with CT. So I hope that answers your question. And maybe more information than you wanted, but at least now you know. And again, it's a great question because we go through this all the time. You know, what if someone is limited on funds and we can only do one? Like right now, I'll give you another perfect example. We used to diagnose heart disease on an x-ray, looking just at this overall size of the heart, the positioning, the trachea, the elevation of the trachea called dorsiflexion, and of course, an ECG, electrocardiogram. Those two are passe now. Now it's echocardiography, because with the echocardiogram, which is an ultrasound of the heart, we can see flow. We can measure wall thickness. We can measure for the Doppler pressure where the blood is flowing through the valves. You can see the valves at work. I mean, it is so much more specific as to functionality, not just size. Whereas with an x-ray, you just get size, but you don't, and position, but you don't get functionality, you don't get flow, you can't take measurements. So if you really want, that's why your doctor's not recommending it, because it's more expensive. In fact, most GPs, I don't do it. I have to send you to a cardiologist. And in my case, I have a cardiologist that comes to me and they do the echoes at my office, which I like better because we have everything there and I get my results almost immediately. So it's more effective, but that's what the cardiologists do. So it's very important to know that it's not like you're being taken. It's helping you. All right. While I was talking in my big mouth, I couldn't keep it shut. White spots. Okay. Let's see. What are your thoughts on giving a dog CBD drops for seizures? I am very much for CBD. I can't tell you for sure that it's going to work, but I will tell you that there have been a lot of advantages, and in human medicine as well. Are you going to take it knowing, thinking it's going to be 100%? No, but guess what? Guess what? The medicines that we have, levetiracetam, which is Keppra, and phenobarbital, and zonisamide, look all alive, so great either. So I would just add that to what you're using and see. But it's certainly worth trying. Very tiny boil-like white spots on my short hair dog's under chest. Think it's from laying on his belly. What do you think I should do? Okay, so you. Well, I know it's kind of weird to think about this, but they're probably little whiteheads. And so it's probably an allergic reaction, getting little secondary pustules, little pimples. And what you could do if you're gutsy or have your veterinarian do it, just sure, is just take a little fine 25-gauge needle and just prick it. And you can squeeze it. If a little white pus comes out, there's your answer. You can also then just treat it like get an antibacterial shampoo, something with chlorhexidine, maybe some ketoconazole, and let it soak. There are a lot of good wipes. My For Real shampoo has those two ingredients. My Dermamist spray or my Dermamist wipes, okay, my Derma wipes, they have the chlorhexidine and the ketoconazole. And just try that, bathing with an antibacterial shampoo, let it soak, kind of work your fingernails into them and see how they respond. But the best thing to do if you really want an answer to know if you're on the right track would be to, you know, give a little prick. Chances are it'd be best to have your veterinarian or one of your vet techs do that. Okay. More waving. Let's see. I love the waving. I also love the questions. Okay. See how easy it is? Okay, hold on. Why is MRI so expensive? Oh, MRI is expensive because the machine's so expensive. I mean, look at for people as well. You're not going to see many general practices with an MRI. So it's got to be at a specialty facility. And it's a very, very costly machine, several hundred thousand dollars. So yeah, I mean, when you figure out pricing, you have to look at what you're spending. And if you're leasing it, and a lot of people do that, a lot of veterinarians that have MRIs or veterinary specialty facilities, they don't buy them outright, they lease them. And so you got to make sure, you have to figure out how many times you're using it, what's the frequency of use, and you got to divide that by that number, obviously work in a profit. So it is very, very, very expensive. And that's why most GPs, for me, even something like endoscopy, I would love to do endoscopy. I know I think be good at it. I'm pretty good hands-eye. I think it's really cool, but I'd have to justify it. I ask myself, how many cases that I see on a regular basis do I send for endoscopy? Would I send to one of my two friends, the internists that do endoscopy? And I realize it's not even one a month. So for me to buy or lease a machine that I'm only going to use maybe once a month, then the argument from the other side says, well, if you have it, you use it more often. But the question is, do I really need it? If I need it, and I don't hesitate. If I think I need it, I'm going to send it. I'm not going to guess around it. I'm not going to tiptoe, dance around it. No, if it needs endoscopy, I'm going to send it for endoscopy. So those are the case. When I say that, I mean, it's not like doing it because I'd rather do and keep the case in-house. I have no ego when it comes to that. If endoscopy is the answer, then that's what I'm going to do. If MRI is the answer, that's what I'm going to recommend. I just don't have that many cases that require it. There are so many other ways now, for example, with ultrasound, with just logic and good common sense and following something on an X-ray. Look at the gas in the belly. If I think there's an obstruction, let's put it this way. Very rarely have I gone in for an obstruction based on all my parameters and my diagnostics and found nothing. And if I did, I did find a motility defect. So, you know, I think that's the reason why. Best treatment for car sickness. Well, there are two things here. And if you guys, Mark, is it okay if I keep going? Okay. Got the thumbs up from Mark. Great question. So usually car sickness is not motion sickness. So understand that. It is anxiety. So if it's true motion sickness, then you want to use something like Bonine, okay, or Dramamine. So those are, with Bonine is Meclizine, and those are good for true motion sickness. Now, there is a medication called Serenia that we use. It comes in injected, but also comes pills. And interestingly, there are two dose ranges. One is for vomiting, and the other one is for motion sickness. So now I figure that way they're covering their bases. So it's just a matter of how you dose it. But so here's what I like to do. I think it's more anxiety. So I like to work first on the anxiety. I like to desensitize your pet to the car. And by that, I mean, it's a whole process. I'll give you the simple version is you put them in the car, you buckle them in, start the engine, turn the engine off, get them out of the car. Good. No, such a good boy. And give them a treat and go back in the house. And the next day, you do that for a few days, each time a little longer. Then when you think he's now looking forward to now what is his association? Is this a fearful thing? Is this because he's taking me to the groomer or taking me to the vet? No, I'm sitting in the car strapped in. I get treats. So then you pull out. Now you back out of the parking lot or back out of the drive. Okay. And then you back right back in, put in the car off. You get the point. Your drift is you go a little bit more each time. Then you go down the block. Then you go around the block. And then you go stop at a place just in a parking lot somewhere, like at a 7-Eleven or a market. And you do the same thing. No groomer, no vet. And you get to the point where he jumps in that car just willingly knowing that this is going to be a fun experience. And it's a positive experience. And he gets a lot of good boy or good girl. And she's going to get a treat. And then they get to go back in the house and hang. So it's a very slow process of desensitization. Okay. And you're going to basically change that their attitude about it. And then to the point where they actually have positive feelings about being in the car. So that's another treatment. Eloise, Vicky, we can talk about. There may be other things that other people do, but for me, that has worked fairly well. Okay. Keith, how you doing? Dermal wipes. Yeah, no, I think they're great to wipe a dog's butt and paws with baby wipes. Yeah, usually yes, unless they have alcohol. But if they're mild, if you want something like that, I have my Dermal wipes, which are pretty good. But you can just make sure. Yeah, I mean, look, figure it this way. If you're using it on a baby, it's most likely okay for a dog. Does every dog need an express? Does every dog need it? No, not every dog needs it. Some dogs do it themselves. When they defecate, at the very end, this is when I say, you don't have to get too close and personal with your dog. But if you did, and you get really close as they're taking that BM, you watch the very end where they squeeze the tush, you'll see the stuff squirt out. When it does, they're emptying it themselves. When that stops happening, or when the discharge gets a little too thick, or then something's really thick and hardens, then they need to be expressed. Likes to eat egg, healthiest way to feed them. No, I would not. I'm not a fan of raw egg for us. I'm not a fan of raw egg for dogs. However, you can cook it lightly. You want to kill off the salmonella, and then go for it. They like eggs, and eggs are good for them. Hello, Shayna. So I hope you don't miss the kitty too much. Okay, so I know we're at the end for Mark. When I get dirty looks from Mark, I know it's time to say goodbye. All right. Anyway, thanks for joining me here on Pet Life Radio's Ask the Vets with Dr. Jeff. During the week, anytime, you don't have to wait until Sunday to get a hold of me. You all know how to get a hold of me, right? You can either write here on drjeff@petliferadio.com or on Instagram, pop in anytime. And we'd love to talk to you, love to help you out with your pets. The more you have, the merrier. I have 9. I know a lot of you out there have more than one, which is great. And I always say, and I just don't like being morbid. I really don't. But I will tell you that it's never easy when you have to say goodbye to a pet. It is never easy, even though when you 100% know you're doing the right thing. And you're it's a gift. Euthanasia is a gift that we give back to them so they don't have to suffer. So, and the fact that it's a thank you for giving you so many good years, hopefully many good years. But and you know, you're going to send them on to something better. But it does help, I got to tell you. When you walk in after saying goodbye and you walk into an empty house or an empty room or an empty bed, it's tough. But when you have all the other pets greeting you and giving you lots of love, it does help a little bit. All right. So having to put dogs down at a vet. Vicky, too many good questions. We're going to talk about that. How do I feel about putting dogs down as a vet? I just told you. I know I'm doing the right thing. I know I'm helping them. The oath, the veterinarian's oath, is that we have to relieve animal suffering. And when I see that suffering, then I think it's the right thing to do. You know, there's a lot of gray zone. There really is. And I give certain criteria to pet parents to think about. I said, these are not yes or no questions. There's things to think about. And next week, Vicky, you're going to remind me. We're going to open the show. We're going to talk about that because it's a really sensitive, but a great topic. When do you know? And have I ever been put in a position to euthanize a pet that I didn't feel needed to be euthanized? That's another great, great little talk. We can talk about the difference between a guy doing it for 40 years and a guy out for 6 months. And you'll see what I mean when we get to that next week. All right. Have a great week, everybody. Please get a hold of me anytime you want. And I got to tell you, I love doing this. I love helping you guys. And this is why I do what I do. See you next week.
Let's Talk Pets every week on demand, only on PetLifeRadio.com.